Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling something incredibly complex, maybe the most complex system in the body. The central nervous system, the CNS.
That's right, brain and spinal cord. And when trauma hits this system, well, it's not just about fixing an injury. It's suddenly a race against the clock.
A race against the body's own internal response, really. Our sources give us a fantastic, focused look at both head and spine trauma.
Yeah, they do. So our goal here is pretty straightforward. Give you the essentials on the anatomy, how these injuries happen, and crucially, the pre-hospital management priorities. What you need to know in those first critical minutes.
Definitely. And let's start right at the surface, actually, with something maybe a bit surprising. Scalp bleeding. You might think, you know, focus on the big stuff inside.
But you absolutely cannot ignore the scalp. Our sources really hammer this home. It's packed with blood vessels way more than you'd think.
So a deep cut there
can lead to serious, even life-threatening blood loss.
Yeah.
You have to control that bleeding fast. Otherwise, you're fighting shock on top of a potential brain or spine injury. It complicates everything.
Okay, so let's move inwards then. The skull, the cranial vault, 8 bones forming this container.
Right, a container. And its main job is protection, obviously. Protects the brain tissue, the cerebrospinal fluid, CSF, and all the blood vessels.
But the key thing, the really profound thing about this container,
is that it doesn't stretch at all. It's a fixed box.
Yeah.
Non-distensible is the technical term.
And that is the problem, isn't it? When something goes wrong inside. Swelling, bleeding.
Exactly. There's zero extra room in there. So if you get bleeding, or the brain swells, the pressure just builds and builds, and the only thing you can press on is the brain itself.
Which is why certain fractures are such a huge deal, like basilar skull fractures. Those involve the bones right at the base.
Yeah, the floor of the skull, basically. Think ethmoid, sphenoid, parts of the temporal and occipital bones.
And if that breaks?
It means the protective barrier between the inside of your head and the outside world is gone. You can get connections to the sinuses, the ears. It's a major risk for infection, plus the structural damage. We'll touch on the signs later.
Okay. And beneath the bone, you've got more layers of defense, right? The meninges.
Yep. 3 layers wrapping the brain and spinal cord. You've got the dura mater, that's the tough outer layer.
Yeah.
Then the arachnoid, kind of web-like, and the pia mater, which is stuck right onto the brain surface.
Protective layers, but in trauma, they define these dangerous spaces where bleeding can happen.
Precisely. An epidural hematoma. That's bleeding between the skull and the dura.
And that one's often arterial, right? It comes on fast.
Classically, yes. Often involves the middle meningeal artery, can cause rapid deterioration. It's an emergency.
Okay, and the other common one, subdural.
Subdural hematoma happens under the dura. This is actually the most common serious one. It's usually venous bleeding, so it might develop a bit slower. But don't let that fool you. It can be just as deadly.
Slower, but still filling up that fixed box.
Exactly. Which brings us back to how the brain itself gets injured inside that box. The whole coup contra coup thing.
Right. The brain isn't just fixed solid in there, is it? It can move.
It floats, essentially, in the CSF. So imagine a blow to the front of the head, that initial impact point. That's the coup injury.
But then the brain sloshes backward.
And slams into the back of the skull. That's the contra coup injury. So you get damage in 2 places, often opposite each other, from just 1 impact.
Okay, so knowing where the injury is inside the skull can tell us a lot. If we map the functions onto the brain lobes, the cerebrum, the big part, handles all the higher level stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's divided into lobes, each with pretty specific jobs. Understanding these helps predict deficits.
Let's take the frontal lobe. What's happening there?
Well, it's partly about voluntary movement, yeah. But maybe more importantly, it's your personality, your executive functions, judgment, filtering emotions, that kind of thing.
So damage there. It doesn't just affect how you move. It changes who you are.
Fundamentally, it's where you manage those impulses from deeper brain structures like the limbic system. Damage that filter and the person can change dramatically.
Wow. Okay, what about the parietal lobe?
Parietal is more about sensory input. Processing pain, temperature, touch, vibration, and also proprioception.
Proprioception, that's knowing where your body parts are without looking.
Exactly. Super important for coordination and movement. Damage here really messes with your perception of the world and your place in it.
Got it. Then occipital lobe, that one's easier.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah.
Primarily vision, processing what you see.
And the temporal lobe, sounds like it does a lot.
Oh, it's a powerhouse. Speech comprehension, long-term memory formation, hearing, even taste and smell are processed there. Damage can impact any or all of those. Silence someone, erase memories.
Yeah.
It's devastating.
So many critical functions packed in there. And we shouldn't forget the smaller but vital parts, like the cerebellum.
Right, sometimes called the athlete's brain. It's tucked underneath the occipital lobe. Crucial for posture, balance, coordination, fine motor control.
And the brainstem, connecting the cerebrum to the spinal cord.
Absolutely critical. Hmm. Midbrain, pons, medulla. This is ground control for basic survival. Breathing, heart rate, blood pressure, consciousness itself. An injury here is immediately life-threatening.
Okay, this anatomy really sets the stage for understanding traumatic brain injury, TBI. The sources mention some stark numbers, like 61,000 deaths in the U.S. in 2019.
Yeah, the incidence is high, driven mostly by falls, car crashes, firearm injuries, assaults. It's a major public health issue.
And we classify these injuries. You mentioned open versus closed.
Closed is blunt trauma, skull's intact, brain isn't exposed. That's the most common. Open means something penetrated the skull, a bullet, a knife, bone fragment exposing the brain tissue. Much higher risk of infection and often worse outcomes.
But the really crucial distinction for treatment is primary versus secondary injury.
Absolutely. The primary injury happens at the moment of impact. The shearing forces, the bruising, the initial damage. It's done. We can't undo that.
So all our efforts, all the critical care, it's aimed at stopping the secondary injury.
Exactly. That's the damage that happens after the initial hit. Things like swelling, lack of oxygen, hypoxia, reduced blood flow, and especially increased pressure inside the skull.
Okay, pressure. Before we dive into that, let's quickly circle back to those basilar skull fracture signs you mentioned. How do we spot that breach?
There are some classic signs. Clear fluid, CSF, leaking from the ears or nose, bruising around the eyes, they call it raccoon eyes, periorbital ecchymosis, or bruising behind the ear over the mastoid bone, that's Battle's sign. If you see those red flags everywhere, base of skull is compromised.
Got it. Okay, now let's unpack that pressure problem. Intracranial pressure, ICP, it goes up because of bleeding or swelling in that fixed box.
Right. And as ICP climbs, it starts to squeeze the blood vessels inside the brain. This reduces cerebral perfusion pressure, CPP.
CPP, that's basically the pressure needed to push oxygenated blood into the brain tissue.
Exactly. Think of it like this. Blood pressure pushing in minus ICP. Pushing out equals CPP. If ICP gets too high, it equals or exceeds the blood pressure trying to get in.
And blood flow stops. The brain starves.
Precisely. And the body has this, well, this desperate, dangerous way of trying to compensate.
It senses the brain isn't getting enough blood.
So it cranks up the systemic blood pressure. Really high systolic pressure. Trying to force blood into the head against that high ICP.
Which leads to that widening pulse pressure we hear about. The gap between systolic and diastolic gets bigger.
Correct. And that extreme hypertension triggers another reflex through the vagus nerve, which slows the heart rate way down bradycardia.
So high blood pressure, wide pulse pressure, slow heart rate.
That's it. The Cushing triad. It's a late ominous sign. It means the pressure is critically high, the brainstem is likely being compressed, and herniation, where parts of the brain are forced out of their normal position, is probably happening or about to happen.
A sign that things are incredibly dire.
Doesn't get much worse. We should also quickly mention diffuse injuries, ones that affect the brain more globally, like concussions.
Right, concussions, morphofunctional disturbance, neurometabolic changes,
right.
Usually managed with rest.
Yes, but the key takeaway from the sources on concussions is the vulnerability factor. After one concussion, it takes less force to cause another one. And symptoms might be worse or last longer. It's cumulative.
That's important. And the really bad diffuse one.
Diffuse axonal injury, or DAI. This is widespread stretching, shearing, tearing of the nerve fibers, the axons throughout the brain. Often happens in high-speed crashes with rotational forces.
And the main sign.
Profound unresponsiveness, usually lasting more than 6 hours after the injury. DAI often leads to severe long-term disability or vegetative state. That's one of the most devastating TBIs.
Oh.
Okay, let's shift gears now. Down from the head to the spine, the vertebral column.
33 vertebrae stacked up, protecting the spinal cord running through the middle, with those intervertebral discs acting as cushions.
Right, cushions that can unfortunately herniate or rupture under stress, pressing on the cord or nerve roots. And the cord itself is the information highway, transmitting signals between the brain and the body. It tapers down near the bottom into that bundle of nerves called the cauda equina.
And just like the head, the way the spine is injured, the mechanism tells us a lot about potential instability.
Huge amount. Like flexion injuries, think of a head-on collision where the head whips forward, or a blow to the back of the head. That forward bending can really damage the ligaments and bones.
What about falling from a height and landing on your feet?
That's vertical compression. The force goes straight up the spine, can cause burst fractures, where the vertebra basically explodes. Very unstable.
And you mentioned rotation with flexion.
Yeah, that combination is particularly bad for stability. Thankfully, it mostly affects the very top of the neck, C1 and C2. But hyperextension, the head snapping backward, or distraction like a hanging injury, those forces can also cause severe damage.
So when the cord is damaged, we sometimes see these specific patterns, these incomplete syndromes.
Exactly. They're called incomplete because some function usually remains below the level of injury, unlike a complete transection.
What's a common one the sources highlight?
Central cord syndrome. This one's often linked to hyperextension, especially in older people with some pre-existing arthritis. The classic sign is weakness or paralysis that's much worse in the arms than the legs.
Weird. They might be able to walk but can't use their hands.
Pretty much. It affects the central part of the cord more, where the arm fibers run.
Okay, and contrast that with, say, anterior cord syndrome.
Anterior cord usually results from damage to the front part of the spinal cord, often from bone fragments or a disc herniation after a flexion injury.
Mm.
Patients lose motor function, pain, and temperature sensation below the injury.
That they keep.
They often keep light touch, proprioception, and vibration sense because those pathways run in the back part of the cord, the posterior columns. It's a very specific pattern.
And we have to mention the systemic effect of a bad spinal cord injury, neurogenic shock.
Right. Very important not to confuse this with hypovolemic shock from bleeding. Neurogenic shock happens with injuries typically above the P6 level. You lose sympathetic nervous system control below the injury.
So the blood vessels just relax, dilate.
Exactly. Widespread vasodilation. This causes blood pressure to drop, but unlike regular shock where the heart rate speeds up to compensate, here the heart rate often stays normal or even goes slow bradycardia because the sympathetic signals to speed it up are blocked. Managing fluids is tricky.
Okay, so we understand the structures, the injuries, the devastating potential. Mm. Now, boots on the ground, pre-hospital care, what are the absolute must-dos? Starting with spinal motion restriction, SMR.
Yeah, deciding who needs SMR is priority one. You don't just immobilize everyone anymore, but you need a high suspicion based on mechanism.
What kind of mechanism triggers definite SMR, according to the sources?
Things like falls, adults over 20 feet, kids over 10 feet, being ejected from a vehicle, high-speed crashes like a car hitting a pedestrian at over 20 miles per hour, or motorcycle crashes, diving injuries. If you have those mechanisms, you start with manual C-spine stabilization, holding the head still in a neutral inline position.
While you do your primary survey, ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation.
Always. Airway first, but protect that spine while you manage it. And then the single most important neurological sign.
Has to be level of consciousness, LOC, any change.
Any change in LOC is the most sensitive indicator of what's happening inside the head.
Right.
Get a baseline immediately. Use AVPU alert, verbal, pain, unresponsive, and the Glasgow Coma Scale, GCS. Document it. Track it.
Okay, circulation. Stop major bleeding, including that scalp bleeding we talked about.
Hmm?
Direct pressure, but maybe not too much pressure right over a possible skull fracture.
Good point. Firm pressure, but be mindful. Then IV access. Fluids are often needed, especially with neurogenic shock or other bleeding.
Where?
Normal saline or lactated runners.
There's a big but for head injuries, isn't there?
A huge one. If you suspect a severe closed head injury with rising ICP, you have to be really careful with IV fluids. Limit them.
Why? What's the risk of giving too much fluid?
You can make the brain swelling worse. More fluid volume can potentially increase cerebral edema, pushing that ICP even higher. It's a real balancing act. You need enough fluid to perfuse vital organs, but not so much that you worsen the head injury.
And definitely no sugar solutions, right? Like D5W.
Absolutely not. Dextrose solutions are bad news for brain injuries. The sugar gets metabolized and can actually pull more water into the brain cells, worsening edema. Stick to saline or LR.
This all sounds incredibly time sensitive. What do the sources say about time on scene?
They are very clear. For critical trauma patients, especially with potential head or spinal injuries, scene time should ideally be under 10 minutes.
10 minutes, that's fast.
It has to be. The principle is load and go. Identify immediate life threats, manage ABCs, immobilize if needed, and get to a trauma center. The definitive care happens at the hospital. Spending too long on scene trying to perfect things can cost brain and cord function. Rapid transport saves lives.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, about immobilization, you mentioned manual stabilization. But what about the devices? Cervical collars, backboards? There's some debate there now, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Big time. The routine use of long backboards is really being questioned. Our sources point out several potential downsides.
Like what?
Well, they're uncomfortable, obviously. can cause significant pain, especially in the back of the head, sacrum, lower back. They can lead to pressure sores surprisingly quickly. They can restrict breathing, especially in kids or obese patients.
And counterintuitively, maybe even worsen the head injury.
Possibly. An improperly fitted cervical collar, often used with a backboard, can obstruct venous drainage from the head, which could theoretically increase ICP. So the tool meant to help might actually cause harm in some cases.
Which leads to this idea of selective SMR, not putting everyone on a board. How do you decide?
You need a reliable patient first. That means someone who's alert, oriented, cooperative, not intoxicated, no language barrier, no significant distracting injuries.
Distracting injuries, like a badly broken leg that might mask neck pain.
Exactly. If the patient is reliable, then you assess them carefully. Do they have any pain or tenderness when you palpate all along their spine? Do they have a completely normal neurological exam strength, sensation in all limbs?
And if they meet all those criteria, reliable, no pain, normal neuro exam, no distracting injury.
Then according to current guidelines detailed in the sources, you can often safely clear their spine clinically without needing collars or boards. It requires careful assessment, but it avoids the potential downsides of unnecessary immobilization. Hashtag tag outro.
So we've covered a lot. The skull as that unforgiving container, the dangerous cascade of rising ICP leading to Cushing's triad, the specific ways the spine can fail, and these really critical evolving priorities in assessment and management, like selective SMR.
Yeah, it all comes down to protecting that incredibly vulnerable CNS tissue. Preventing the primary injury is ideal, but once trauma happens, everything is focused on minimizing that secondary damage, the swelling, the pressure, the lack of oxygen.
And when you look at the long term, especially for spinal cord injuries, the treatment options after the fact are still pretty limited, aren't they?
Sadly, yes. We're much better at managing the acute phase than reversing permanent neurological damage once it's occurred, which really underscores the importance of, well, not getting injured in the first place.
And that brings us to our final thought for you today. It's maybe less about critical care techniques and more about everyday life, given how devastating these injuries are and how limited the cures can be.
The most effective intervention, really, is prevention. The sources mention simple things: driving safely, wearing seatbelts, using helmets, following safety rules at work or play.
So maybe the most profound takeaway is realizing that protecting this delicate system often starts long before any accident happens. Thinking about those simple safety measures isn't trivial. It's probably the best medicine we have for CNS trauma. Something to keep in mind next time you get behind the wheel.